First thing I want to do is welcome everybody here tonight and thank you for coming out for this incredible event, KPFA in the building. So thank you for supporting us. Marcus Books in the building, thank you for supporting them. For those who don't know me, my name is George Bush, the 43rd president. Now, I'm Davey D from Hard Knock Radio, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's really a pleasure to be here to break bread with this individual here who I've known for a while. He's always been able to give a lot of wisdom on air and off the air, so I always enjoy our conversations. I could read a whole list of things about him. He said, don't do that because we'll be here for a while. So I'm going to say three things. One, race matters, so we know the book, right? He teaches at the Union Theological Seminary in New York, so we know that. He had a book which we talked to him about probably a few months ago called The Black Prophetic Fire, which is incredible, talking about the black prophetic tradition out of the black church, which many people who are in power are doing everything they can to bury it, marginalize it, and make it seem like something that is terrible, when really it's been a liberating force that's driven a whole lot of our consciousness and has laid a foundation for the freedom struggle. So I'm glad that Dr. Cornel West was able to lay that out in this book. His new one is something that I think is right on time, and it's right on time when you consider that just 2 weeks ago, all around the country, including right here in Oakland, you saw 7,000 people come out to the streets. You saw 96 hours of direct action. You heard people talking about Black Lives Matter, and what was the inspiration for it was Dr. King. Not the sanitized version of Dr. King, but the radical, uncompromised man who was ready to kick up dust, Dr. King. And so Cornel West having this book called The Radical King is something that I think is just a perfect storm of what people were already thinking and what this book kind of represents. He's going to talk to you about it, but if you read this book, it's a Dr. King that goes above and beyond I Had a Dream. It's a Dr. King that's talking about critiques on capitalism. It's a Dr. King that's telling you all the ways in which you can love. It's a Dr. King, when you read his own words and the writings and the speeches that they were able to put together, make you truly understand that nonviolence is really a very confrontational type of endeavor that is not for the faint of heart. And so I'm glad that that was captured in this book. So without further ado, can we give it up? A warm round of applause and Oakland welcome for Dr. Cornel West.
What a blessing, what a blessing to be here. First Congregational Church, Oakland, East Bay. Still on fire for justice. Oh, what an honor for me to be here with my brothers and sisters of all colors. I want to begin by, of course, saluting my dear brother David D. Nobody like him, I'm telling you. Public intellectual truth teller, rooted in the music, but his heart is golden. I want to acknowledge, of course, the magnificent radio brothers and sisters. I mean, KPFA. I am just so glad all of the folk who work, and not just now, but even in the past, you know, the tradition of truth-telling on radio, which is more and more difficult and unbelievably challenging operation. Give it up again for KPFA. Oh, we want to thank y'all. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then there is the bookstore that is so dear to my heart, Marcus Books. Marcus Books. Marcus Books. oldest book, black bookstore in the country, the Richardson family. Where's Sister Blanche? Where's Sister Blanche? Stand up, Sister Blanche Richardson. Please, where is she? Where is she? Is she? She's out working at the bookstore, huh? Lord, no, we'll bring her in. We want to take a look at her. She's an extension of that. Well, maybe she, is she on the way? Is she on the way? Okay, well, just tell her that we send our love and respect. Is she on the way there? All right, no, I always decided I would either start my book tour at Human Books in Harlem, which shut down just recently, or Marcus. Oh, indeed, indeed, indeed. And I see that my dear brother Marvin X is here. Good God Almighty. Oh, so good to see you, brother. Stand up, stand up. Still going. Black arts movement still alive. He's trying to keep it alive in a marvelous, marvelous way. I see brother Ricky Vincent in the house, one of the grand distinguished historians. Stand up, my brother. History of funk, history of funk, history of the loving proletariat and the cultural analog of the Black Panther Party. So glad to see you. I could go on and on. There's so many magnificent folk here. I do want to apologize, though, because I had planned to be able to spend 3 or 4 hours, but I've got to be in Chicago tomorrow because they canceled my flight. And so we'll still spend our time together, but I will have to make a run to get to the airport to get to Chicago. I've got 3 talks in Chicago. You all know about Linus, the storm that's hitting Chicago. For those who are religious, say a prayer. And if not, think pleasant thoughts. But most importantly, I want to keep the focus on the young people because I come from a tradition that says that the spirit will not descend without song, without sound. And when I came in here and listened to the young folk bringing alive not just the legacy, not just the talent, but the genius of the Louis Armstrongs and Duke Ellingtons and Count Basies and Mary Lou Williams and Sarah Vaughns and Billie Holidays, on into the Curtis Mayfields and the Donny Hathaways and the Aretha Franklins and the Sheila and Wanda Hutchison of the Emotions, and of Scotty of the Whispers, Ted Mills of Blue Magic, Russell Tompkins Jr. of the Stylistics. That's the same tradition, y'all. That's the same tradition. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. And it is a tradition not primarily of entertainers. It is a tradition of love warriors who mastered technique and craft and tried to touch souls in such a way that even though you've been terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized for 400 years, you can still stand with your back straight with a smile on your face and with style and connect with other folk, communicate with other folk, so you may come from a hated people, but you're going to teach the world something about love. That's what we heard here. That's what we heard here. So I'm not the only brother smiling, but it put a smile on Sly Stone's face wherever he is. Because that's the same tradition. And of course, it affects each and every one of us, no matter what color, no matter what culture, civilization, sexual orientation, or national identity. It is profoundly a human affair. Oh, yes, it is. You know, our English word, humando, comes from the Latin humando, is the source of the English humanity. And humando means what? Burying. That we're on the way to death. And when you hear this music, it comes from a black people who at our best have always been wrestling with forms of death. the social death of U.S. white supremacist slavery, the civic death of American Jim and Jane Crow American terrorism, the psychic death of being taught that you are less moral, less beautiful, and less intelligent, less human, and the spiritual death that you have no status whatsoever on the human scale, and therefore the only thing for you to do is to cave in, or give up, or sell out. In the black musical tradition, which for me is the greatest tradition of modern times at that deep philosophical level, because it says even if we're on intimate terms of terror, intimate terms of trauma, intimate terms with stigma, the response is not to terrorize others. The response is not to stigmatize others. The response is not to traumatize others. It is to allow a love to flow. And we know justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. And you can't talk about the black freedom struggle. You certainly can't talk about Martin Luther King Jr. unless you begin with a spiritual and existential dimension that says, yes, we're going to fight for freedom. Yes, we're going to serve the poor. Yes, we're going to sacrifice for justice, but we're also going to have a militant tenderness. Oh, yeah. This music that you heard comes from a people who taught the world something about tenderness. And I'm not just talking about Otis Redding saying, try a little tenderness. That's a little different when I hear the folk, young folk these days talking about, say my name, say my name, say my name. Try a little tenderness. That's empowering for people who have been taught that their bodies are abomination. So when they're tenderly touched, they're empowered and ennobled. Able to actually conceive of an alternative reality as opposed to the cold, cruel world that all of us have to come to terms with every day. There is no Martin Luther King Jr. without Mahalia Jackson. And he would be the first to tell you. I was talking to Brother Andy Young a few years ago, and he told me about seeing Martin after he'd been in that paddy wagon in the dark with a German shepherd for 4.5 hours on the way from Atlanta to Reedsville prison in Tattnall County in gut bucket Jim Crow, Georgia. When he got out of that paddy wagon, he could hardly walk. It looked as if he had had a nervous breakdown. And he could only say one sentence. This is the cross we must bear for the freedom of our people. And he said, and I kept playing over in my mind Mahalia Jackson singing. And all of us can relate to the music preserving our sanity as well as our dignity, the soothing of a sweetness against the backdrop of the darkness of forms of death, be it catastrophic slavery, Jim Crow, or Jim Crow Jr., prison industrial complex, residential housing, segregated education. And all you need to do is look at the Academy Awards or look at the Grammys, and it's still Jim Crow-like. Oh, yes, it is. When you reach a point where the award for rhythm and blues look more like the National Hockey League than the NBA, you know something is going on. And I ain't got nothing against Sam Smith or Robin Thicke or Justin Timberlake, but if they think somehow that they're the greatest inheritors of Marvin Gaye and Donny Hathaway, they got another thought coming. I appreciate their efforts. We had Hall and Oates in our day, and they were talented, but they knew they were footnotes to the Delphonics. We had the Righteous Brothers. We appreciate it, but Sam and Dave will make them sit down. An Average White Band, oh, we love the funk of Average White Band. But as soon as James Brown and Maceo came in, hey, They got to take a seat, not because it's a matter of skin pigmentation. It's a matter of the standards of highest levels of what the Greeks call arete, excellence. And are digging deep into the dark corners of your own soul and somehow transfiguring your pain into a sound that relates to people at the visceral level. That's what we're talking about. And Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. is a product of that tradition. That's why my brother David D. is so right. The last thing we need to do is to deodorize Brother Martin. We got to keep it funky. Is that right, Brother Vincent? We got to keep it funky. And how do you keep it funky? You recognize that in the end with featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creatures born between urine and feces. That's where we come from. We all emerge in the funk. That's what George Clinton, that's what Bootsy Collins. That's what Millie Jackson. Which is to say, yes, that love push that got us out. And the fact that very soon our bodies will be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms. That's funky too. And that includes all of us. And that's what's so rich and deep about the black freedom struggle. The black musical tradition, political, economic, social, all goes hand in hand. You don't compartmentalize it in such a way that you lose sight of the integrity, the honesty, the decency, the courage, and the vision. I want to turn very briefly to the four questions raised by Du Bois before I get to Brother Martin. Because anytime you talk about any figure of the black freedom struggle, it could be our dear brother Mary Baraka. It's passed now 1 year. It could be our dear sister Alice Walker. It could be Toni Morrison. It could be Martin King or Ella Baker or Fannie Lou Hamer. It could be anonymous mothers, grandmothers, fathers, grandfathers, and ancestors who don't make the textbook, but who without their vision, their courage, and most importantly, their love, there would be no black freedom struggle. And we put them center stage too. Those the great Sly Stone called everyday people. Those the great James Cleveland called ordinary people. But Du Bois says there's four questions that he's wrestling with, and it relates directly to the question of what and who Martin King was. And this is Du Bois in 1957. He's 89 years old. He's been handcuffed just a few years before by the U.S. government for his work for the Information Peace Center. He's been characterized as working for a foreign government. He's under house arrest. He's living in Brooklyn. He only has one visitor, a genius named Paul Robeson, who was also under house arrest in Philadelphia. He said, I want to write a trilogy of three novels, and he did. And the first novel was called The Ordeal of Manzart. And you turn to page 275 in that novel. And he says, these four questions. How shall integrity face oppression? Integrity face oppression. The second question, what does honesty do in the face of deception? Third, what does decency do in the face of insult? And the last query, how does virtue meet brute force? I want you to keep the focus on those four pillars. Integrity, these days, of course, what do we see? Cupidity. Love of money. Everything's for sale. Everybody's for sale. Across the board, no matter what color. And I'm not just talking about politicians. It's across the board. All you got to do is just dangle enough money, and somehow they will defer. I'll never forget the encounter of Martin Luther King Jr. with Whitney Young and the other civil rights leaders when they said he's setting the movement back. You ought to be shaming yourself and your critique of the Vietnam War. You ought to be shaming yourself trying to organize poor people because we're about civil rights and you trying to go international and you trying to sound socialist. And what did Martin say? And Martin was a nonviolent man, but he almost slapped him upside the head. Abernathy had to hold him back. And he said, what you say may get you big money from corporation sponsors, but it won't get you a foothold in the kingdom of truth. That's integrity, y'all. Because he understood the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. And he's going to keep track of those who are suffering, no matter how unpopular it might be at the moment. He's willing to sacrifice his popularity in the name of what? Integrity. And all he's trying to do is be true to the best of the black musical tradition. There's integrity in the voice of a David Ruffin. There's integrity in the voice of a Nina Simone. There's integrity in Miles Davis's horn. Maybe not his life, but his music. We talking about art. It's always bigger than the individuals who engage in it because they allow themselves to become part of a tradition that shapes them in the same way Martin Luther King Jr.'s life was not perfect, but he was made by the movement just like he helped make the movement. And when he was at the center of that movement, he was an exemplary figure in terms of not purity, but integrity. Oh, that's very important. That's why the Black Panther Party could still talk about something positive with Martin, even if they disagree with him ideologically and politically. Why? Because he said, this Negro is for real. He won't sell his soul for a mess of pottage. And it's why Christian folk could look at Malcolm and put his name on the wall and say, lo and behold, we disagree with you, Malcolm, but one thing is very clear. You're right when you say, sincerity of my credentials, he's for real. Malcolm not going to sell out. That's crucial, especially these days. And this is not just for black folk. We live in such a market-driven, commodified, commercialized, marketized society. It saturates every nook and cranny, and the powers that be know all they got to do is just dangle some things. And lo and behold, folk come running. Oh, when we talk about Martin Luther King Jr., that's like talking about John Coltrane. We ought to shake and tremble and shiver and quiver and say they human, but lo and behold, they set such a high standard of integrity. Oh, we're not going to play with them. All these folks can get together every January if they want to and talk about how much they love Martin. And what do I say? Quit lying. 72% of Americans disapproved of him when he, at the end of his life. 55% of black people disapproved of Brother Martin at the end of his life. Now that the worms got his body, now he's so popular. J. Edgar Hoover said he's the most dangerous man in America. Kept track of him every day from January 1956 till the day he died. We find out after 10,000 photographs taken of him by his photographer, the photographer was an FBI informant. Oh, that's not the Martin we like to talk about. We like to Santa Clausify Brother Martin. Turn him into Santa Claus, got a nice big bag with toys in it, big smile, everybody feeling good, no challenge, no unsettling, no unnerving anybody. Everybody just in on the celebration. You say, no, no, we're going to keep it funky. We're going to tell the truth. I was blessed to be in upstate New York a couple of years ago. That old black preacher came up to me about 82 years old. He said, Brother Wes, I want to tell you the truth now. You see this big old room you're in? You had 800 people here tonight. He said, I was here when Brother Martin came up here after he came out against the war, after he came out with his poor people's campaign, bringing poor people across the board after he had his critique of plutocratic capitalism with the 1% owning at that time 28% of the wealth. Now it's 43% of the wealth. And only 200 people showed up. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, yeah. And he said, and some of the black leaders and black preachers mobilized against him and told them not to show up because he was a communist, believing the vicious lies of the New York Times, the vicious lies of Washington Post that said that Martin Luther King Jr.'s voice was an extension of Radio Hanoi. How mendacious can you be? How mendacious can you get? And Martin said what? He would step up in every speech after April 4th, 1967 in Riverside Church when he talked about the silence being a betrayal in regard to the vicious crimes of the American empire. You say, you never knew me. You never knew my calling. You never knew my commitment. I'm the same brother. I'm the same Jesus-loving free black man. Y'all tried to convince yourselves I was just a civil rights leader? No. That was a particular issue that had to do with how you respond to a vicious legacy of white supremacy at that moment. But I'm also concerned about working people. I'm also concerned about poor people. I could hear him saying, I'm concerned about the vicious legacy of male supremacy. He did speak honestly about the anti-Jewish hatred that was running around. He would still want to talk about anti-Jewish hatred. But he would also talk about vicious Israeli occupation. Oh, yes, he wanted to be morally consistent because he knew that an Israeli baby is precious, but just as precious as a Palestinian baby. They go hand in hand. He's got to be consistent. He's got what Jane Austen called constancy. Concerned about a white baby in Newtown, Connecticut, but he was also concerned about brown babies in East Los Angeles, or yellow babies in San Francisco, or red babies in Canada, the aboriginals, or what we call here precious indigenous brothers and sisters. That's the kind of brother he was. But he wasn't alone. He's not an isolated individual to be put on some pedestal. He's a wave in an ocean of a great moment in a tradition of a people who've been dishing out unbelievable love warriors since the first African stepped foot on this slave-owning land and met that slave auction. So here comes Frederick Douglass. Here comes Harriet Tubman. There goes Sojourner Truth. That's Martin. They go hand in hand. The last thing he ever wants is somehow folk to view him as the exceptional Negro that incorporates him into some national narrative of exceptionalism and loses sight of the preciousness of Letitia on the corner in the hood trying to make her way to school. A decrepit school, too often characterized by soul murder, what goes on the inside, or dealing with massive unemployment or underemployment, or indecent housing. He would never want us to sever that connection between his ascension and those catching hell. And it means the radical king forces us to orient ourselves very much against the dominant tendencies of the last 30 years in the history of the American empire. Because we have witnessed a top-down class war against poor and working people with massive transfer of wealth from poor and working people to the well-to-do. We have witnessed the financializing of a monopoly capitalist economic system. When Martin King was alive, it was multinational corporations like American Motors Company that were still oligarchic, but they produce products. Under financialization, it shifted to big banks. They don't produce products. They produce deals. The high level of profit making in the highly financialized capitalist world does not translate on the ground to increase wages of working people. So that stock markets can break records and hedge fund folk can break dance on the way to the bank. And yet the masses of working people and poor people are not just catching hell, but further and further and further behind. So that 40% of children of color in America can live in poverty, and we don't have a major public conversation about poverty. That 22% of all of Americans' children, each one precious, living in poverty and not have a major conversation about poverty. So you can have a president who talks about the State of the Union and talks about how strong it is. And I say, my dear brother Barack Obama, you might be beautifully black, but you're spiritually deficient and morally underdeveloped if you think America is strong at this moment. I don't know what you're looking at. You're spending too much time with the 1%. You're spending too much time looking at Wall Street. Have you seen the masses of American peoples? Have you looked at the children, not just their material condition, but their spiritual condition? The spiritual malnutrition, the emptiness of soul, the moral constipation of the elites who might have a dim sense of what's right, but it stopped flowing a long time ago because it's stuck with greed and avarice and callousness and indifference toward the suffering of other people. That's the Martin Luther King Jr. that we need, the spirit of it. Now, one of the manifestations of that spirit is found in Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Why? Because Michelle Alexander says that, lo and behold, if we're really concerned about truth and the condition of truth allows suffering to speak, then we ought to say something about this bogus war on drugs, a war against poor people, especially chocolate poor people, but it's poor people across the board. The quadrupling that's taken place since 1980. I've been blessed to teach in prisons now for 37 years. I just finished my class at Rahway Prison in New Jersey. We read Plato, we read Lorraine Hansberry, we read Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, we read Augustine's Confessions, we read Toni Morrison. Why? Because they are rendered so often not just invisible, but superfluous. As Brother Davey D says in his wonderful classes at San Francisco State, disposable. Disposable. And then that spiritual war on our young folk. We wonder why they can't play instruments like Ohio Players. Arts programs gone in New York City. I don't know about Oakland. You see. Or they can make $1 million and some of them can't sing in tune. And Nat King Cole turns over in his grave. Carmen McRae turns over in her grave. Hit the notes right. You don't have to hit the notes right to be successful anymore. It's all PR. It's a culture of superficial spectacle. So much depends on how you look and how you appear and how you project yourself. Superficial image rather than substantial performance. I ain't got nothing against Beyonce, but she ain't no Aretha. She's a great entertainer, but it's spectacle. That's the how she looks. She had to shake her thing. And all of the projection of the glitz and the blitz, and all Aretha had to do was step up, grab the microphone, sing the song from her soul, and you still felt something deep, very deep. I tell young folk all the time, Ferguson's on the move. Occupy's on the move. You got young folk hungry and thirsty. Now, what's your soundtrack sound like? What kind of music have you written in the last 10 years that's going to sustain you in the midst of what's coming at you, which is repression, co-optation, lies, and a whole host of other things? You better get your spirit intact for that kind of struggle, and Rihanna ain't going to do it. Now, again, I ain't got nothing against Rihanna. But compared to Gladys Knight, come on now. This is not an attack on young folk. This is a situating of a moment where our young people have been under a war coming at them, and it is spiritual, it is cultural, it is educational, it is political, and it is economic. When you heard these young folk play, and you didn't get a chance to meet Sister Octavia Moore. Where is Sister Octavia? Where? Stand up, sister. Stand up. Octavia Moore here. This sister right here now. 15 years old in 10th grade with a magnificent exhibition right here in the room with a rich history, memory, bringing together what has been dismembered, dispersed, scattered in the name of what? In the name of the same tradition that I'm talking about. She's a wave in that same tradition. And Martin would never want us to talk about him without also talking about all of those who've had the courage to do what? Lift their voice. That's the anthem of a black people. To lift your voice. And that's different than just lifting an echo or being an echo. That's what's happened in the last 30 years with this war against poor and working people, and especially the war against the youth. We teach them. We want you to be an imitation of what comes at you from corporate media so you can be successful. And to be successful means to gain access to material status, even if you're well adjusted to injustice. Even if you're well adapted to indifference, that's all right. Just be successful. And Martin used to say what? Don't tell me what you're successful about if you can't define what you're faithful to and what you're using your success for. You're going to end up generating a whole generation of peacocks walking around talking about how successful they are, unrelated to folk catching hell. Peacocks strut because they can't fly. Martin comes from a people of eagles who fly high with style and keep track of what's going on the ground. Oh, that's something different. That cuts against the grain. Martin Luther King Jr. would have come back today and he would look, especially at the black community, one of the first things he would say is, my God, I see unbelievable numbers of black professionals in so many different contexts. But looks like they've been re-niggerized. They got more money. They got bigger houses. They got bigger cars. But they still scared. They still afraid. They still intimidated. They don't really want to tell the truth, either on the job or in public. And when you niggerize the people, you keep them so afraid and scared and intimidated that they walk around laughing when it ain't funny and scratching when it don't itch and wearing the mask just to be acceptable in a white mainstream and want to, you to be elevated because the white mainstream is approving of you rather than the fundamental point of reference, which is integrity, honesty, decency, virtue, no matter what color you are. That's Brother Martin. That's why he's such a challenge. And that's why when you mess with him, oh, Lord, you got to be ready to be unsettled. He unsettles me every time I think of him, let alone teach him. And I rarely teach him like I rarely teach Coltrane or Curtis Mayfield because they're too close. It's like teaching my mama or my daddy. It's too much. It's too close to the soul. It hurts too much. But somehow you got to still try to pass it on to the younger generation. Martin Luther King Jr. was a blues man. And the blues is fundamentally about how you wrestle with catastrophe. Catastrophe. It could be the moral catastrophe of xenophobia, of whatever kind. Racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-Arab, anti-Jewish, anti-Muslim. Losing sight of the humanity of the physically challenged. Economic catastrophe, maldistribution of wealth, unaccountability of big banks, big corporations, vicious attacks, trade union movement, working people. It could be nuclear catastrophe. We ought not to ever forget about that. 17,000 nuclear warheads we still have. Russia has over 10,000. Pakistan, UK, Israel, a few others. It could be ecological catastrophe. What is distinctive about the black musical tradition is it produced the dominant idiom of the 20th and 21st century, which is how you gonna deal with catastrophe. And for people who've been on intimate terms with catastrophe, nation with the blues, planet with the blues, you either learn something from a blues people or you lose all the best of what your ancestors created. That's the fundamental question. When Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel says the very future of America depends on how America responds to Martin Luther King Jr. and his legacy. He's a Torah-loving free Jewish brother who tells the truth about wrestling with catastrophe because he comes from a tradition that has been on intimate terms with catastrophe too. B.B. King says, nobody loves me but my mama, and she might be jiving too. That's catastrophic. That's like Sophocles' Antigone, isn't it? Everything in the world and the cosmos is against you, and you thought you could depend on your sister, and she's lukewarm and milquetoast. But how does B.B. sing it? With a smile on his face, because he's rooted in a tradition that has learned to channel his rage through love and justice and not hatred and revenge. Fundamental question. If you channel that rage in response to catastrophe with hatred and revenge, you reinforce the dominant cycle of history, which is that of hatred, revenge, domination, exploitation, and dehumanization. You got to somehow break it. You got to disrupt it. You got to interrupt it and provide some space so that some humanity can come through at that deep level. That's what Martin and the music's about. But you got to be a long distance runner. You can't come out of the block sprinting and run out of gas in the second lap. We know if Martin were alive today, he would still be fighting, swinging, just like Malcolm, like so many others. That's what we have to learn in our own distinctive lives. Not imitating them, but building on that radical love, radical integrity, radical decency, that radical sense of virtue, not in the spirit of self-righteousness. Martin would always say before every major sermon, sinner that I am. I love that beginning. Because I know I was a gangster before I met Jesus, and I'm now a redeemed sinner with gangster proclivities. That's exactly who I am. So you see me doing something ungodly, I told you so. So what? I got bounced back. Beckett says, try again, fail better. Try again, fail better. We all end up relative failure. So what?
We can still make some movement. We can still connect. We can still organize. We can still mobilize. We can keep a vision knowing what the standards are. These are the landmark of those who came before, who aspired to the highest levels of integrity. Even they fell on their faces. Look at their bounce back. That's what the music's about, y'all. And it's all in Martin. It's through every word, every action. Why? Because he's part of what the Isley Brothers call a caravan of love. And that's all it is. It's a love of truth. It's a love of justice. It's a love of neighbor. And it's an acknowledgement that we need each other in the struggle for justice. Thank you all so very much. Stay strong.
God bless you.